Welcome to the deep dive. Today, we're venturing into a text really renowned for its profound wisdom, the Srimad Bhagavatam.
That's right. And specifically, we're zoning in on Canto 7.
Yes. Within this huge ocean of text, Canto 7 is, well, it's particularly charged with insight, wouldn't you say?
Definitely. It really gets to the heart of some fundamental questions we all grapple with, you know, the nature of good versus evil, suffering.
The allure of power.
Exactly. And ultimately, paths to inner peace.
Right. So our mission here is to really extract the core wisdom for you from this canto. We'll be navigating that powerful story of Hiranyakashipu and his son Prahlada.
It's such a stark narrative. It lays bare the conflict between, well, destructive ego and this really transformative devotion.
And it showcases the strength of faith, even under extreme pressure. We know you want to understand this stuff deeply, but also efficiently. So think of this as your shortcut to some truly timeless wisdom.
Okay, so let's start where Canto 7 itself kicks off. It begins with a question, actually. Yudhishthira asks the sage Narada something quite profound.
And it still feels incredibly relevant today, doesn't it?
It really does. He asks, essentially, why do good people sometimes suffer so much while, you know, people who act unjustly seem to prosper?
The age-old question.
Precisely. And this question perfectly sets the stage for the whole story we're about to unpack.
And Narada answers with this epic tale of Hiranyakashipu.
Yeah.
Now, he wasn't just like a standard villain.
No, not at all. He was a powerful Asura. Think of that as being driven by ego, by dominance.
And he was consumed by this intense rage.
Absolutely. His brother had been killed by Lord Vishnu in his Varaha avatar, the boar form.
Right, the boar incarnation.
And Hiranyakashipu was just fixated on two things, revenge and achieving immortality. Nothing less.
That level of determination is kind of staggering.
It led him to perform these incredible austerities, really intense practices, all aimed at pleasing Lord Brahma.
And eventually Brahma was pleased. He granted him this remarkable boon.
Remarkable is right. It was a set of conditions that, on the surface, seemed to make him absolutely invincible.
Yeah, let's break that down. He couldn't be killed by any human or any animal.
Not indoors, not outdoors.
Not during the day, not during the night.
Not on the ground, not in the air.
And not by any known weapon.
It's like he covered every conceivable possibility.
He really thought he had. I mean, you have to consider the implications of that. It wasn't just strength. It was like trying to cheat the laws of nature itself.
And, as you might guess, getting this cosmic loophole, well, it went straight to his head. His ego just exploded.
Immense arrogance. And his rule became this reign of terror, basically.
Yeah.
Fear and oppression everywhere.
Exactly. Which sets up this incredible dramatic contrast with his very own son, Prahlada.
And such a different character. Even from a really young age, Prahlada was just gentle, wise.
And deeply, deeply devoted to Lord Narayana. That's another name for Vishnu.
He was the absolute polar opposite of his power-hungry father.
It's almost unbelievable, isn't it, that they could be father and son?
Totally. And Prahlada faced constant threats from Hiranyakashipu. We're talking serious, life-threatening abuse.
Terrible things. Yet through it all, his faith, it just never wavered. Not once.
He remained completely steadfast in his devotion. It's quite inspiring.
And this unwavering faith, it all builds up to the story's incredible climax. Hiranyakashipu, in his peak arrogance, he challenges Prahlada.
He demands to know, where is this lord of yours? Right.
Yes. And Prahlada, calm as ever, replies, he is everywhere.
And bam, that's when Vishnu manifests, but in a form that completely sidesteps all those conditions of the boon.
This is where it gets really mind-bending. Lord Narasimha appears, bursting out of a pillar.
Not just any form, neither fully human nor fully animal, half man, half lion.
Exactly. And the timing. It was twilight, that in-between time, neither day nor night.
And location. Narasimha placed Hiranyakashipu on his lap.
Which is neither earth nor sky.
And he used his claws, which aren't conventional weapons, but they're not weapons either.
It's this perfect divine circumvention of every single clause of that boon.
It's fascinating how every detail lines up to counter Hiranyakashipu's supposed invincibility.
It really is. It's such a powerful illustration that the divine operates beyond our, you know, limited human logic. It can overcome seemingly insurmountable barriers.
And the whole event becomes this potent symbol, doesn't it? The defeat of that inflated ego.
And the ultimate triumph of pure, unshakable devotion.
But the story doesn't just end with Hiranyakashipu's demise.
No, Narada continues. He goes on to explain more about the fundamental nature of the soul, our individual soul.
and the nature of material existence, how it can be illusory sometimes.
Right. And most importantly, he emphasizes the supreme effectiveness of bhakti,
which we can understand as that loving devotion, that complete surrender.
As the most direct path to liberation, to freedom.
Okay, so that brings us neatly into the core philosophical themes, the moral takeaways woven through this whole narrative.
Let's start with Hiranyakashipu. He's really the archetype of ego, isn't he?
Absolutely. Consumed by power, the need for control.
Hmm.
He basically ends up demanding worship of himself.
It's fascinating psychologically, too. That kind of extreme narcissism often masks a deep insecurity, wouldn't you say?
Oh, for sure. And his whole quest for immortality,
yeah,
rejecting any authority higher than himself, it's just ego 101.
His story is such a stark cautionary tale. It reminds us just how temporary all that material strength, all those worldly achievements really are.
No matter how powerful he seemed, how clever his boon was, he was still subject to a higher divine will.
Right. It makes you think about the pressures we feel, you know, the need to control things, feeling overwhelmed. Hiranyakashipu's fall shows that clinging to that false sense of control is, well, ultimately futile.
It really does. Now flip that coin and you look at Prahlada.
And you see the absolute glory of pure devotion. His bhakti. It's always described as unwavering, fearless, totally pure.
Even when his own father is threatening him, treating him brutally, he just refuses to compromise his belief.
The courage there is immense, just sheer conviction.
And it wasn't just a personal private thing either. The Bhagavan says he actually shared his understanding. He taught his classmates.
In the demon school, can you imagine?
Right. He's teaching them about the eternal soul, about how fleeting material pleasures are in this environment, totally hostile to his views.
It just highlights the power of that inner conviction, and it perfectly illustrates Sharanagati.
That concept of complete unconditional surrender.
Yes. Prahlada's calmness under pressure, his compassion even for his own tormentor, and his absolute trust in the Lord's protection. It's all there.
It's a powerful example. And the text makes it clear that this path, bhakti, it's universal.
Absolutely. It doesn't matter who you are, your background, your age. It's an inherent capacity within us all.
And then there's Narasimha's appearance. Talk about unexpected.
It completely defies logic, doesn't it? The symbolism is so specific, neither man nor beast, twilight, the threshold, the claws.
And as we discussed, each detail directly counters a condition of Brahma's boon.
It's this incredible demonstration that the divine reality, it's just bigger than our categories, our constraints. It operates beyond logic.
It really underscores the boundless nature of the Supreme.
It certainly does. And for anyone devoted, it offers this profound reassurance, you know?
That divine protection is real. It's guaranteed.
Even if it shows up in ways you could never predict or even imagine.
Yeah, seemingly illogical ways sometimes.
Another really key point in Canto 7 is the emphasis on early spiritual education.
This part is fascinating. The Bhagavatam actually says Prahlada's deep spiritual insights began in the womb.
Yes, hearing teachings from Narada even before he was born. It suggests how powerful those early, even prenatal influences can be.
That is such an intriguing detail. And like we said, he then becomes this teacher of Dharma, of righteousness, to his own friends.
It shows that even young children have this innate capacity for deep spiritual understanding.
It really makes you reflect on our world today, doesn't it? The importance of instilling those core inner values early on.
Absolutely. And linking to that, Prahlada constantly talks about real happiness.
He keeps driving home this point.
Mm.
Chasing external pleasures, material things.
Ah.
It just leads to dissatisfaction in the end.
True happiness, lasting happiness, he says, comes from realizing your spiritual identity, your connection to the Supreme Lord.
He talks about the eternal nature of the soul and how forgetting that truth is the real misfortune.
And you see the contrast so clearly. Hiranyakashipu is restless, always craving more power, more control.
Well, Prahlada has this deep inner peace, this contentment.
It's a powerful argument for focusing inward on the spiritual path if you're seeking genuine, lasting happiness.
So, okay, we've explored these deep teachings within the story.
Mm-hmm.
The big question then is, how do we actually apply this stuff? How does it relate to our daily lives?
That's the million-dollar question, isn't it? Let's take resisting ego first.
Yeah, that one hits close to home. In work, in relationships,
mm-hmm.
their urge to dominate, to always be right, to control the outcome.
Thinking about Hiranyakashipu's spectacular fall, it's actually a really potent reminder, isn't it, about the value of humility.
Definitely. And what about cultivating devotion, especially when life is so busy, so full of distractions?
It's a real challenge. Modern life isn't always set up to support spiritual growth.
Not always, no.
But Canto 7 suggests it's about conscious choice. We can still carve out time, even small amounts, for practices like prayer or meditation or just quiet reflection on these kinds of texts.
Consistency and sincerity seem key. Little and often, maybe.
Exactly. And then there's maintaining faith during hard times. Prahlada's example is just immense here.
Unimaginable adversity, yet his faith held strong.
So when we face our own difficulties, problems at work, personal loss, whatever it might be, remembering that Prahlada was protected, even in the darkest moments.
It can give real strength.
Mm-hmm.
Help cultivate trust in maybe a larger divine timing or plan.
And that point about early values. Raising children.
Connecting Prahlada's early understanding to how we raise kids today.
It feels so relevant. Consciously trying to foster kindness, honesty, maybe a sense of spiritual curiosity in the next generation.
And finally, that focus on the eternal self. In a world so focused on materialism, on external validation.
Canto 7 really pushes us to ask bigger questions. Who am I, really? What's the purpose of all this?
It circles back to that very first question Yudhishthira asked Narada, doesn't it?
It does. Now, maybe we should step back for a second and see where Canto 7 fits in the grand scheme of the whole Srimad Bhagavatam.
Good idea. Because it's not just a standalone story. It plays a really crucial role in the larger text.
It's pivotal, multifaceted even. It works on multiple levels.
Right. It's a gripping narrative, yes, but it's also laying down fundamental theology, outlining key spiritual truths.
And at the same time, it's a practical guide, offering real insights into living a more spiritually aware life.
What seems significant is the shift in focus compared to earlier cantos.
Exactly. Earlier parts deal a lot with cosmology, creation, different divine incarnations.
But Canto 7 really turns the lens inward. It examines that internal battlefield.
The struggle between our higher self and lower self. Selflessness versus selfishness. Ego versus devotion.
And it provides this beautiful balance to other key concepts in the Bhagavatam, like karma.
The law of action and reaction.
And jnana, the path of intellectual knowledge.
While acknowledging those are important, Canto 7 really hammers home that bhakti, that loving devotional connection.
Is the most direct, the most complete path to liberation, to real lasting joy.
It powerfully reinforces the Bhagavatam's overall message, really.
And we can't forget the significance of Prahlada himself as the teacher here.
That's such a key point. The fact that a child is the central authoritative teacher in this canto.
It completely demolishes the idea that spiritual wisdom is only for, you know, the old or the learned scholars.
It powerfully suggests it's accessible to anyone, anyone with a sincere, open heart, regardless of status or age.
So, wrapping up this deep dive, it's clear Canto 7 is much more than just an ancient myth.
Oh, absolutely. It's a profound exploration of human nature itself, of spiritual truth, and the sheer power of divine grace.
That stark contrast between Hiranyakashipu's pride and Prahlada's surrender.
And where each path ultimately leads.
It feels incredibly relevant. It's a timeless lesson for navigating life, really.
And the struggles it depicts with ego, with fear, with doubt. They're universal, aren't they?
Every single one of us faces those things in our own way.
And Prahlada's example, that unwavering faith.
Yeah.
It offers such a powerful source of guidance through those very challenges.
Which brings us to maybe a final thought for you, the listener.
In a world that often feels so uncertain, so full of noise and distraction, the teachings of Canto 7 seem to point towards a different kind of happiness.
A lasting happiness. One that doesn't come from grabbing more stuff or more control.
But from understanding who we really are deep down, from a sense of surrender to something larger than ourselves.
And from living a life rooted in compassion and devotion.
So perhaps the question to ponder is which path, the path of ego or the path of surrender, resonates most deeply with you right now? Where do you feel drawn?